Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke. Performed by Peter Ganim. Produced by Audible, Inc.
Hello, and welcome to Audible.com's unabridged reading of the science fiction classic Rendezvous with Rama by the late, great Sir Arthur C. Clarke. My name is Robert J. Sawyer, and I'm a science fiction writer myself. Sir Arthur was my all-time favorite science fiction writer. No one has ever done a better job of engendering that sense of wonder that good science fiction is supposed to bring about, that feeling of transcendence, of realizing just how big and incredible the universe really is, that special thrill that comes from beholding what Canadian poet Archibald Lampman called the wide awe and wonder of the night. Now, in the science fiction field, there are three major awards for the best novel of the year. There's the Hugo, which is the International People's Choice Award, voted on by the attendees of the annual World Science Fiction Convention. Then there's the Nebula, which is the field's Academy Award, voted on by the active members of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. And finally, the John W. Campbell Memorial Award, named for the great editor of the SF magazine originally called Astounding Stories, and now known as Analog. The Campbell is the field's principal juried award. Now, as it happens, one of my books has won the Hugo, another, the Nebula, and a third, the Campbell Memorial. But in the whole history of science fiction, only three books have ever taken all three of those awards, SF's true triple crown. These books are Frederick Pohl's Gateway, Joe Haldeman's Forever Peace, and the one you're about to hear, Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama. Now, what makes this book so special? Well, in fairness, you'll quickly discover that it's not the characters. Those were never Clarke's main concern. He was never particularly interested on a literary level in individual human beings, but he was endlessly fascinated by humanity as a whole and its place in this great, vast universe of ours. It's a tricky thing to make the reader or the listener feel both humbled and exhilarated at the same time, but Sir Arthur manages both here. Prepare to be astounded as you have your own Rendezvous with Rama.
1. Space Guard. Sooner or later, it was bound to happen. On June 30th, 1908, Moscow escaped destruction by 3 hours and 4,000 kilometers, a margin invisibly small by the standards of the universe. On February 12th, 1947, another Russian city had a still narrower escape, when the second great meteorite of the 20th century detonated less than 400 kilometers from Vladivostok, with an explosion rivaling that of the newly invented uranium bomb. In those days, there was nothing that men could do to protect themselves against the last random shots in the cosmic bombardment that had once scarred the face of the moon. The meteorites of 1908 and 1947 had struck uninhabited wilderness, but by the end of the 21st century, there was no region left on Earth that could be safely used for celestial target practice. The human race had spread from pole to pole, and so, inevitably, at 09:46 GMT on the morning of September 11th, in the exceptionally beautiful summer of the year 2077, most of the inhabitants of Europe saw a dazzling fireball appear in the eastern sky. Within seconds, it was brighter than the sun, and as it moved across the heavens, at first in utter silence, it left behind it a churning column of dust and smoke. Somewhere above Austria, it began to disintegrate, producing a series of concussions so violent that more than 1 million people had their hearing permanently damaged. They were the lucky ones. Moving at 50 kilometers a second, 1,000 tons of rock and metal impacted on the plains of northern Italy, destroying in a few flaming moments the labor of centuries. the cities of Padua and Verona were wiped from the face of the earth, and the last glories of Venice sank forever beneath the sea, as the waters of the Adriatic came thundering landward after the hammer blow from space. 600,000 people died, and the total damage was more than $1 trillion. But the loss to art, to history, to science, to the whole human race for the rest of time, was beyond all computation. It was as if a great war had been fought and lost in a single morning, and few could draw much pleasure from the fact that, as the dust of destruction slowly settled, for months the whole world witnessed the most splendid dawns and sunsets since Krakatoa. After the initial shock, mankind reacted with a determination and a unity that no earlier age could have shown. Such a disaster, it was realized, might not occur again for 1,000 years, but it might occur tomorrow. And the next time, the consequences could be even worse. Very well. There would be no next time. 100 years earlier, a much poorer world, with far feebler resources, had squandered its wealth attempting to destroy weapons launched suicidally by mankind against itself. The effort had never been successful, but the skills acquired then had not been forgotten. Now they could be used for a far nobler purpose, and on an infinitely vaster stage. No meteorite large enough to cause catastrophe would ever again be allowed to breach the defenses of Earth. So began Project Space Guard. 50 years later, and in a way that none of its designers could ever have anticipated, it justified its existence. 2. Intruder. By the year 2130, the Mars-based radars were discovering new asteroids at the rate of 12 a day. The Space Guard computers automatically calculated their orbits and stored the information in their own enormous memories, so that every few months, any interested astronomer could have a look at the accumulated statistics. These were now quite impressive. It had taken more than 120 years to collect the first 1,000 asteroids, since the discovery of Ceres, largest of these tiny worlds, on the very first day of the 19th century. Hundreds had been found and lost and found again. They existed in such swarms that one exasperated astronomer had christened them Vermin of the Skies. He would have been appalled to know that Space Guard was now keeping track of 500,000. Only the five giants, Ceres, Pallas, Juno, Eunomia, and Vesta, were more than 200 kilometers in diameter. The vast majority were merely oversized boulders that would fit into a small park. Almost all moved in orbits that lay beyond Mars. Only the few that came far enough sunward to be a possible danger to Earth were the concern of Space Guard. And not one in 1,000 of these, during the entire future history of the solar system, would pass within 1,000,000 kilometers of Earth. The object first cataloged as 31-439, according to the year and the order of its discovery, was detected while it was still outside the orbit of Jupiter. There was nothing unusual about its location. Many asteroids went beyond Saturn before turning once more toward their distant master, the Sun. And Thule II, most far-ranging of all, traveled so close to Uranus that it might well be a lost moon of that planet. But a first radar contact at such a distance was unprecedented. Clearly, 31-439 must be of exceptional size. From the strength of the echo, the computers deduced a diameter of at least 40 kilometers. Such a giant had not been discovered for 100 years. That it had been overlooked for so long seemed incredible. Then the orbit was calculated, and the mystery was resolved, to be replaced by a greater one. 31439 was not traveling on a normal asteroidal path, along an ellipse, which it retracted with clockwork precision every few years. It was a lonely wanderer among the stars, making its first and last visit to the solar system, for it was moving so swiftly that the gravitational field of the sun could never capture it. It would flash inward past the orbits of Jupiter, Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury, gaining speed as it did so, until it rounded the sun and headed out once again into the unknown. It was at this point that the computers started flashing their "We have something interesting" sign, and for the first time, 31439 came to the attention of human beings. There was a brief flurry of excitement at Space Guard headquarters, and the interstellar vagabond was quickly dignified by a name instead of a mere number. Long ago, the astronomers had exhausted Greek and Roman mythology. Now they were working through the Hindu pantheon, and so 31439 was christened Rama. For a few days, the news media made a fuss over the visitor, but they were badly handicapped by the sparsity of information. Only two facts were known about Rama: its unusual orbit and its approximate size. Even this last was merely an educated guess, based upon the strength of the radar echo. Through the telescope, Rama still appeared as a faint 15th magnitude star, much too small to show a visible disk. But as it plunged in toward the heart of the solar system, it would grow brighter and larger month by month. Before it vanished forever, the orbiting observatories would be able to gather more precise information about its shape and size. There was plenty of time, and perhaps during the next few years, some spaceship on its ordinary business might be routed close enough to get good photographs. An actual rendezvous was most unlikely. The energy cost would be far too great to permit physical contact with an object cutting across the orbits of the planets at more than 100,000 kilometers an hour. So the world soon forgot about Rama, but the astronomers did not. Their excitement grew with the passing months as the new asteroid presented them with more and more puzzles. First of all, there was the problem of Rama's light curve. It didn't have one. All known asteroids, without exception, showed a slow variation in their brilliance, waxing and waning in a period of a few hours. It had been recognized for more than 2 centuries that this was an inevitable result of their spin and their irregular shape. As they toppled end over end along their orbits, the reflecting surfaces they presented to the sun were continually changing, and their brightness varied accordingly. Rama showed no such changes. Either it was not spinning at all, or it was perfectly symmetrical. Both explanations seemed unlikely. There the matter rested for several months, because none of the big orbiting telescopes could be spared from their regular job of peering into the remote depths of the universe. Space astronomy was an expensive hobby, and time on a large instrument could easily cost $1,000 a minute. Dr. William Stenton would never have been able to grab the far side 200-meter reflector for a full quarter of an hour if a more important program had not been temporarily derailed by the failure of a 50-cent capacitor. One astronomer's bad luck was his good fortune. Stenton did not know what he had caught until the next day, when he was able to get computer time to process his results. Even when they were finally flashed on his display screen, it took him several minutes to understand what they meant. The sunlight reflected from Rama was not, after all, absolutely constant in its intensity. There was a very small variation, hard to detect, but quite unmistakable, and extremely regular. Like all the other asteroids, Rama was indeed spinning. But whereas the normal day for an asteroid was several hours, Rama's was only 4 minutes. Stenton did some quick calculations and found it hard to believe the results. At its equator, this tiny world must be spinning at more than 1,000 kilometers an hour. It would be rather unhealthy to attempt a landing anywhere except at the poles, because the centrifugal force at the equator would be powerful enough to flick any loose objects away from it at an acceleration of almost 1 gravity. Rama was a rolling stone that could never have gathered any cosmic moss. It was surprising that such a body had managed to hold itself together and had not long ago shattered into 1,000,000 fragments. An object 40 kilometers across, with a rotation period of only 4 minutes. Where did that fit into the astronomical scheme of things? Dr. Stenton was a somewhat imaginative man, a little too prone to jump to conclusions. He now jumped to one that gave him an uncomfortable few minutes indeed. The only specimen of the celestial zoo that fitted this description was a collapsed star. Perhaps Rama was a dead sun, a madly spinning sphere of neutronium, every cubic centimeter weighing billions of tons. At this point, there flashed briefly through Stenton's horrified mind the memory of that timeless classic, H.G. Wells's The Star. He had first read it as a small boy, and it had helped to spark his interest in astronomy. Across more than 2 centuries of time, it had lost none of its magic and its terror. He would never forget the images of hurricanes and tidal waves, of cities sliding into the sea, as that other visitor from the stars smashed into Jupiter and then fell sunward past the Earth. True, the star that old Wells described was not cold, but incandescent, and wrought much of its destruction by heat. That scarcely mattered. Even if Rama was a cold body, reflecting only the light of the sun, it could kill by gravity as easily as by fire. Any stellar mass intruding into the solar system would completely distort the orbits of the planets. The Earth had only to move a few 1,000,000 kilometers sunward, or starward, for the delicate balance of climate to be destroyed. The Antarctic ice cap could melt and flood all low-lying land, or the oceans could freeze and the whole world be locked in eternal winter. Just a nudge in either direction would be enough. Then Stenton relaxed and breathed a sigh of relief. This was all nonsense. He should be ashamed of himself. Rama could not possibly be made of condensed matter. No star-sized mass could penetrate so deeply into the solar system without producing disturbances that would have betrayed it long ago. The orbits of all the planets would have been affected. That, after all, was how Neptune, Pluto, and Persephone had been discovered. No, it was utterly impossible for an object as massive as a dead sun to sneak up unobserved. In a way, it was a pity. An encounter with a dark star would have been quite exciting while it lasted. 3. Rama and Sita. The extraordinary meeting of the Space Advisory Council was brief and stormy. Even by the 22nd century, no way had yet been discovered of keeping elderly and conservative scientists from occupying crucial administrative positions. Indeed, it was doubted if the problem ever would be solved. To make matters worse, the current chairman of SAC was Professor Emeritus Olaf Davidson, the distinguished astrophysicist. Professor Davidson was not much interested in objects smaller than galaxies, and never bothered to conceal his prejudices. And though he had to admit that 90% of his science was now based upon observations from space-borne instruments, he was not at all happy about it. No fewer than 3 times during his distinguished career, satellites specially launched to prove one of his pet theories had done precisely the opposite. The question before the council was straightforward enough. There was no doubt that Rama was an unusual object, but was it an important one? In a few months, it would be gone forever, so there was little time in which to act. Opportunities missed now would never recur. At a rather horrifying cost, a space probe, soon to be launched from Mars to go beyond Neptune, could be modified and sent on a high-speed trajectory to meet Rama. There was no hope of a rendezvous. It would be the fastest flyby on record, for the two bodies would pass each other at 200,000 kilometers an hour. Rama would be observed intensively for only a few minutes, and in real close-up for less than a second. But with the right instrumentation, that would be long enough to settle many questions. Although Davidson took a jaundiced view of the Neptune probe, it had already been approved, and he saw no point in sending more good money after bad. He spoke eloquently on the follies of asteroid chasing and on the urgent need for a new high-resolution interferometer on the moon to prove the newly revived Big Bang theory of creation once and for all. That was a grave tactical error, because the 3 most ardent supporters of the modified steady-state theory were also members of the council. They secretly agreed with Davidson that asteroid chasing was a waste of money. Nevertheless, he lost by 1 vote. 3 months later, the space probe, rechristened CETA, was launched from Phobos, the inner moon of Mars. The flight time was 7 weeks, and the instrument was switched to full power only 5 minutes before interception. Simultaneously, a cluster of camera pods was released to sail past Rama so that it could be photographed from all sides. The first images, from 10,000 kilometers away, brought to a halt the activities of all mankind. On a billion television screens, there appeared a tiny, featureless cylinder, growing rapidly second by second. By the time it had doubled its size, no one could pretend any longer that Rama was a natural object. Its body was a cylinder so geometrically perfect that it might have been turned on a lathe, one with centers 50 kilometers apart. The 2 ends were quite flat, apart from some small structures at the center of one face, and were 20 kilometers across. From a distance, when there was no sense of scale, Rama looked almost comically like an ordinary domestic boiler. Rama grew until it filled the screen. Its surface was a dull, drab gray, as colorless as the moon, and completely devoid of markings, except at one point. Halfway along the cylinder, there was a kilometer-wide stain, or smear, as if something had once hit and splattered, ages ago. There was no sign that the impact had done the slightest damage to Rama's spinning walls, but this mark had produced the slight fluctuation in brightness that had led to Stenton's discovery. The images from the other cameras added nothing new. However, the trajectories their pods traced through Rama's minute gravitational field gave one other vital piece of information: the mass of the cylinder. It was far too light to be a solid body. To nobody's great surprise, it was clear that Rama must be hollow. The long-hoped-for, long-feared encounter had come at last. Mankind was about to receive the first visitor from the stars. 4. Rendezvous. Commander Norton remembered those first TV transmissions, which he had replayed so many times, during the final minutes of the rendezvous. But there was one thing no electronic image could possibly convey, and that was Rama's overwhelming size. He had never received such an impression when landing on a natural body like the Moon or Mars. Those were worlds, and one expected them to be big. Yet he had also landed on Jupiter 8, which was slightly larger than Rama, and that had seemed quite a small object. It was easy to resolve the paradox. His judgment was wholly altered by the fact that this was an artifact, millions of times heavier than anything that man had ever put into space. The mass of Rama was at least 10 trillion tons. To any spaceman, that was not only an awe-inspiring, but also a terrifying thought. No wonder that he sometimes felt a sense of insignificance, and even depression, as that cylinder of sculptured, ageless metal filled more and more of the sky. There was also a sense of danger here that was wholly novel to his experience. In every earlier landing, he had known what to expect. There was always the possibility of accident, but never of surprise. With Rama, surprise was the only certainty. Now, Endeavour was hovering less than 1,000 meters above the north pole of the cylinder, at the very center of the slowly turning disk. This end had been chosen because it was the one in sunlight. As Rama rotated, the shadows of the short, enigmatic structures near the axis swept steadily across the metal plane. The northern face of Rama was a gigantic sundial, measuring the swift passage of its 4-minute day. Landing a 5,000-ton spaceship at the center of a spinning disk was the least of Norton's worries. It was no different from docking at the axis of a large space station. Endeavour's lateral jets had already given her a matching spin, and he could trust Lieutenant Joe Calvert to put her down as gently as a snowflake, with or without the aid of the navigation computer. "In 3 minutes," said Calvert, without taking his eyes from the display screen, "we'll know if it's made of antimatter." Norton grinned, recalling some of the more hair-raising theories about Rama's origin. If that unlikely speculation was true, in a few seconds there would be the biggest bang since the solar system had been formed. The total annihilation of 10,000 tons would, briefly, provide the planets with a second sun. Yet the mission profile had allowed for even this remote contingency. Endeavour had squirted Rama with one of her jets from a safe 1,000 kilometers away. Nothing whatsoever had happened when the expanding cloud of vapor arrived on target, and a matter-antimatter reaction involving even a few milligrams would have produced an awesome fireworks display. Norton, like all space commanders, was a cautious man. He had looked long and hard at the northern face of Rama in choosing the point of touchdown. After much thought, he had decided to avoid the obvious spot, the exact center, on the axis itself. A clearly marked circular disc, 100 meters in diameter, was centered on the pole, and he had a strong suspicion that this must be the outer seal of an enormous airlock. The creatures who had built this hollow world must have had some way of taking their ships inside. This was the logical place for the main entrance, and he thought it might be unwise to block the front door with his own vessel. But this decision generated other problems. If Endeavor touched down even a few meters from the axis, Rama's rapid spin would start her sliding away from the pole. At first, the centrifugal force would be very weak, but it would be continuous and inexorable. Norton did not relish the thought of his ship slithering across the polar plain, gaining speed minute by minute until she was slung off into space at 1,000 kilometers an hour when she reached the edge of the disk. It was possible that Rama's minute gravitational field, about 1,000th of Earth's, might prevent this from happening. It might hold Endeavor against the plane with a force of several tons, and if the surface was sufficiently rough, the ship might stay near the pole. But Norton had no intention of balancing an unknown frictional force against a quite certain centrifugal one. Fortunately, Rama's designers had provided an answer. Equally spaced around the polar axis were three low, pillbox-shaped structures, about 10 meters in diameter. If Endeavor touched down between any two of these, the centrifugal drift would fetch her up against them, and she would be held firmly in place, like a ship glued against a quayside by the incoming waves.
"Contact in 15 seconds, said Calvert. As he tensed himself above the duplicate controls, which he hoped he would not have to touch, Norton became acutely aware of all that had come to focus on this instant of time. This, surely, would be the most momentous landing since the first touchdown on the moon, over a century and a half ago. The gray pillboxes drifted slowly upward outside the control port. There was the last hiss of a reaction jet and a barely perceptible jar. In the weeks that had just passed, Commander Norton had often wondered what he would say at this moment. But now that it was upon him, history chose his words, and he spoke almost automatically, barely aware of the echo from the past. "Rama Base, Endeavor has landed." As recently as a month ago, he would never have believed it possible. The ship had been on a routine mission, checking and emplacing asteroid warning beacons, when the order came. Endeavor was the only spacecraft in the solar system that could possibly make a rendezvous with the intruder before it whipped around the sun and hurled itself back toward the stars. Even so, it had been necessary to rob three other ships of the solar survey, which were now drifting helplessly until tankers could refuel them. Norton was afraid that it would be a long time before the skippers of Calypso, Beagle, and Challenger would speak to him again. Even with all the extra propellant, it had been a long, hard chase. Rama was already inside the orbit of Venus when Endeavor caught up with it. No other ship could have done so. This privilege was unique, and not a moment of the weeks ahead was to be wasted. 1,000 scientists on Earth would have cheerfully mortgaged their souls for this opportunity. Now, they could only watch over the TV circuits, biting their lips and thinking how much better they could do the job. They were probably right, but there was no alternative. The inexorable laws of celestial mechanics had decreed that Endeavor would be the first and the last of all man's ships to make contact with Rama. The advice he was continually receiving from Earth did little to alleviate Norton's responsibility. If split-second decisions had to be made, no one could help him. The radio time lag to mission control was already 10 minutes and increasing. He often envied the great navigators of the past, before the days of electronic communications, who could interpret their sealed orders without continual monitoring from headquarters. When they made mistakes, no one ever knew. Yet, at the same time, he was glad that some decisions could be delegated to Earth. Now that Endeavour's orbit had coalesced with Rama's, they were heading sunward like a single body. In 40 days, they would reach perihelion and pass within 20 million kilometers of the sun. That was far too close for comfort. Long before then, Endeavour would have to use her remaining fuel to nudge herself into a safer orbit. The crew would have perhaps 3 weeks of exploring time before they parted from Rama forever. After that, the problem would be Earth's. Endeavour would be virtually helpless, speeding on an orbit that could make her the first ship to reach the stars in approximately 50,000 years. There was no need to worry, Mission Control had promised. Somehow, regardless of cost, Endeavour would be refueled, even if it proved necessary to send tankers and abandon them in space once they had transferred every gram of propellant. Rama was a prize worth any risk short of a suicide mission. And, of course, it might even come to that. Commander Norton had no illusions on this score. For the first time in 100 years, an element of total uncertainty had entered human affairs. And uncertainty was one thing that neither scientists nor politicians could tolerate. If that was the price of resolving it, Endeavour and her crew would be expendable. 5. First EVA. Rama was silent as a tomb, which perhaps it was. There were no radio signals on any frequency, no vibrations that the seismographs could pick up, apart from micro-tremors undoubtedly caused by the sun's increasing heat. No electrical currents, no radioactivity. It was almost ominously quiet. One might have expected that even an asteroid would be noisier. What did we expect? Norton asked himself. A committee of welcome? He was not sure whether to be disappointed or relieved. The initiative, at any rate, appeared to be his. His orders were to wait for 24 hours, then to go out and explore. Nobody slept much that first day. Even the crew members not on duty spent their time monitoring the ineffectually probing instruments or simply looking out the observation ports at the starkly geometrical landscape. Is this world alive? They asked themselves over and over again. Is it dead? Or is it merely sleeping? On the first EVA, Norton took only one companion, Lieutenant Commander Carl Mercer, his tough and resourceful life support officer. He had no intention of getting out of sight of the ship, and if there was any trouble, it was unlikely that a larger party would be safer. As a precaution, however, he had 2 more crew members, already suited up, standing by in the airlock. The few grams of weight that Rama's combined gravitational and centrifugal fields gave them were neither help nor hindrance. They had to rely entirely on their jets. As soon as possible, Norton decided, he would string a cat's cradle of guide ropes between the ship and the pillboxes, so that they could move around without wasting propellant. The nearest pillbox was only 10 meters from the airlock, and Norton's first concern was to check that the contact had caused no damage to the ship. Endeavour's hull was resting against the curving wall with a thrust of several tons, but the pressure was evenly distributed. Reassured, he began to drift around the circular structure, trying to determine its purpose. He had traveled only a few meters when he came across an interruption in the smooth, apparently metallic wall. At first, he thought it was some peculiar decoration, for it seemed to serve no useful function. 6 radial grooves, or slots, were deeply recessed in the metal, and lying in them were 6 crossed bars, like the spokes of a rimless wheel, with a small hub at the center. But there was no way in which the wheel could be turned, because it was embedded in the wall. Then he noticed, with growing excitement, that there were deeper recesses at the ends of the spokes, nicely shaped to accept a clutching hand. Claw? Tentacle? If one stood so, bracing against the wall and pulled on the spokes, so smooth as silk, the wheel slid out of the wall. To his utter astonishment, for he had been virtually certain that any moving parts would have become vacuum welded ages ago, Norton found himself holding a spoked wheel. He might have been the captain of some old windjammer standing at the helm of his ship. He was glad that his helmet's sunshade did not allow Mercer to read his expression. He was startled, but also angry with himself. Perhaps he had already made his first mistake. Were alarms now sounding inside Rama, and had his thoughtless action already triggered some implacable mechanism? But Endeavour reported no change. Her sensors still detected nothing except faint thermal crepitations and his own movements.
Well, Skipper, are you going to turn it?
Norton thought once more of his instructions. Use your own discretion, but proceed with caution. If he checked every single move with mission control, he would never get anywhere. What's your diagnosis, Carl? He asked.
It's obviously a manual control for an airlock, probably an emergency backup system in case of power failure. I can't imagine any technology, however advanced, that wouldn't take such precautions.
And it would be failsafe, Norton told himself. It could be operated only if there was no possible danger to the system. He grasped 2 opposing spokes of the windlass, braced his feet against the ground, and tested the wheel. It did not budge. Give me a hand, he said to Mercer. Each took a spoke. Exerting their utmost strength, they were unable to produce the slightest movement. Of course, there was no reason to suppose that clocks and corkscrews on Rama turned in the same direction as they did on Earth.
Let's try the other way, suggested Mercer.
This time, there was no resistance. The wheel rotated almost effortlessly through a full circle. Then, very smoothly, it took up the load. 0.5 meter away, the curving wall of the pillbox started to move, like a slowly opening clamshell. A few particles of dust, driven by wisps of escaping air, streamed outward like dazzling diamonds as the brilliant sunlight caught them. The road to Rama lay open. 6. Committee. It had been a serious mistake, Dr. Bose often thought, to put the United Planets headquarters on the moon. Inevitably, Earth tended to dominate the proceedings, as it dominated the landscape beyond the dome. If they had to build here, perhaps they should have gone to Farside, where that hypnotic disk never shed its rays. But Of course, it was much too late to change, and in any case, there was no real alternative. Whether the colonies liked it or not, Earth would be the cultural and economic overlord of the solar system for centuries to come. Dr. Bose had been born on Earth and had not emigrated to Mars until he was 30, so he felt that he could view the political situation fairly dispassionately. He knew now that he would never return to his home planet, even though it was only 5 hours away by shuttle. At age 115, he was in perfect health, but he could not face the reconditioning needed to accustom him to 3 times the gravity he had enjoyed for most of his life. He was exiled forever from the world of his birth. Not being a sentimental man, he had never let this depress him unduly. What did depress him sometimes was the need for dealing, year after year, with the same familiar faces. The marvels of medicine were all very well, and certainly he had no desire to put back the clock, but there were men around this conference table with whom he had worked for more than half a century. He knew exactly what they would say and how they would vote on any given subject. He wished that someday one of them would do something totally unexpected, even something quite crazy. And probably they felt exactly the same way about him. The Rama Committee was still manageably small, though doubtless that would soon be changed. His 6 colleagues, each representing one of the members of the United Planets, were all present in the flesh. They had to be. Electronic diplomacy was not possible over solar system distances. Some elder statesmen, accustomed to the instantaneous communications that Earth had long taken for granted, had never reconciled themselves to the fact that radio waves took minutes, or even hours, to journey across the gulfs between the planets. "Can't you scientists do something about it?" they had been heard to complain bitterly when told that immediate face-to-face conversation was impossible between Earth and any of its remoter children. Only the moon had the barely acceptable 1.5-second delay, with all the political and psychological consequences that implied. Because of this fact of astronomical life, the moon, and only the moon, would always be a suburb of Earth. Also present in person were specialists who had been co-opted to the committee. Professor Davidson, the astronomer, was an old acquaintance. Today, he did not seem his usual irascible self. Bose knew nothing of the infighting that had preceded the launch of the first probe to Rama, but the professor's colleagues had not let him forget it. Dr. Thelma Price was familiar through her numerous television appearances, though she had first made her reputation 50 years ago during the archaeological explosion that had followed the draining of that vast marine museum, the Mediterranean. Bose could still recall the excitement of that time, when the lost treasures of the Greeks, the Romans, and 12 other civilizations were restored to the light of day. That was one of the few occasions when he was sorry to be living on Mars. The exobiologist Carlisle Pereira was another obvious choice. So was Dennis Solomons, the science historian. Bose was slightly less happy about the presence of Conrad Taylor, the celebrated anthropologist, who had made his reputation by uniquely combining scholarship and eroticism in his study of puberty rites in late 20th century Beverly Hills. No one, however, could possibly have disputed the right of Sir Lewis Sands to be on the committee. A man whose knowledge was matched only by his urbanity, Sir Lewis was reputed to lose his composure only when called the Arnold Toynbee of his age. The great historian was not present in person, however. He stubbornly refused to leave Earth, even for so momentous a meeting as this. His stereo image, indistinguishable from the real one, apparently occupied the chair to Bose's right, and, as if to complete the illusion, someone had placed a glass of water in front of him. Bose considered this sort of technological tour de force an unnecessary gimmick, but it was surprising how many undeniably great men were childishly delighted to be in two places at once. Sometimes this electronic miracle produced comic disasters. Bose had been at one diplomatic reception when somebody had tried to walk through a stereogram and discovered, too late, that it was the real person. And it was even funnier to watch projections trying to shake hands. Now, His Excellency the Ambassador from Mars to the United Planets called his wandering thoughts to order, cleared his throat, and said, "Gentlemen, the committee is now in session. I think I am correct in saying that this is a gathering of unique talents, assembled to deal with a unique situation. The directive that the Secretary General has given us is to evaluate that situation and to advise Commander Norton when necessary." This was a miracle of oversimplification, and everyone knew it. Unless there was a real emergency, the committee might never be in direct contact with Commander Norton, if, indeed, he ever heard of its existence. The committee was a temporary creation of the United Planets Science Organization, reporting through its director to the Secretary General. It was true that the Solar Survey was part of the UP, but on the operations, not the science side. In theory, this should not make much difference. There was no reason why the Rama Committee, or anyone else for that matter, should not call up Commander Norton and offer helpful advice. But deep space communications were expensive. Endeavor could be contacted only through PlanetCom, which was an autonomous corporation famous for the strictness and efficiency of its accounting. It took a long time to establish a line of credit with PlanetCom. Somewhere, someone was working on this, but at the moment, PlanetCom's hard-hearted computers did not recognize the existence of the Rama Committee.
"This Commander Norton," said Sir Robert McKay, the ambassador from Earth, "has a tremendous responsibility. What sort of person is he?"
"I can answer that," said Professor Davidson, his fingers flying over the keyboard of his memory pad.
He frowned at the screenful of information and started to make an instant synopsis.
"William Tien Norton, born 2077, Brisbane, Oceania, educated Sydney, Bombay, Houston. Then 5 years at Astrograd, specializing in propulsion. Commissioned 2102. Rose through usual ranks. Lieutenant on the third Persephone expedition. Distinguished himself during 15th attempt to establish base on Venus. Exemplary record. Dual citizenship, Earth and Mars. Wife and one child in Brisbane, wife and two in Port Lowell, with option on third."
"Wife?" asked Taylor, innocently.
"No, child, of course," snapped the professor, before he caught the grin on the other's face.
Mild laughter rippled around the table, though the overcrowded terrestrials looked more envious than amused. After a century of determined effort, Earth had still failed to get its population below the target of 1 billion.
"Appointed Commanding Officer Solar Survey Research Vessel Endeavor, first voyage to retrograde satellites of Jupiter, that was a tricky one, one asteroid mission when ordered to prepare for this operation, managed to beat deadline."
The professor cleared the display and looked at his colleagues.
"I think we were extremely lucky, considering that he was the only man available at such short notice. We might have had the usual run-of-the-mill captain.
He sounded as if he was referring to the typical peg-legged scourge of the spaceways, pistol in one hand and cutlass in the other.
The record proves only that he's competent, objected the ambassador from Mercury. Population 112,500, but growing. How will he react in a wholly novel situation like this?
On Earth, Sir Lewis Sands cleared his throat. A second and a half later, he did so on the moon.
Not exactly a novel situation, he reminded the Hermian. Even though it's 3 centuries since it last occurred, if Rama is dead or unoccupied, and so far all the evidence suggests that it is, Norton is in the position of an archaeologist discovering the ruins of an extinct culture.
He bowed politely to Dr. Price, who nodded in agreement.
Obvious examples are Schliemann at Troy and Muot at Angkor Wat. The danger is minimal, though, of course, accident can never be completely ruled out.
But what about the booby traps and trigger mechanisms these Pandora people have been talking about?
Asked Dr. Price.
Pandora? Asked the Hermian ambassador quickly. What's that?
It's a crackpot movement, explained Sir Robert,
with as much embarrassment as a diplomat was ever likely to show.
That is convinced that Rama is a grave potential danger. A box that shouldn't be opened, you know.
He doubted if the Hermian did know. Classical studies were not encouraged on Mercury.
Pandora paranoia, snorted Taylor.
Oh, of course such things are conceivable, but why should any intelligent race want to play childish tricks?
Well, even ruling out such unpleasantness, Sir Robert continued, we still have the much more ominous possibility of an active inhabited Rama. Then the situation is one of an encounter between 2 cultures at very different technological levels. Pizarro and the Incas, Piri and the Japanese, Europe and Africa. Almost invariably, the consequences have been disastrous for one or both parties. I'm not making any recommendations. I'm merely pointing out precedents.
Thank you, Sir Robert, replied Bose. It was a mild nuisance, he thought, having 2 sirs on 1 small committee. In these latter days, knighthood was an honor few Englishmen escaped.
I'm sure we've all thought of these alarming possibilities, but if the creatures inside Rama are, malevolent, will it really make the slightest difference what we do?
They might ignore us if we go away.
What, after they've traveled billions of miles and thousands of years?
The argument had reached the takeoff point, and was now self-sustaining. Bose sat back in his chair, said little, and waited for a consensus to emerge. It was just as he had predicted. Everyone agreed that, once he had opened the first door, it was inconceivable that Commander Norton should not open the second.
7. 2 Wives.
If his wives ever compared his videograms, Commander Norton thought, with more amusement than concern, it would involve him in a lot of extra work. Now, he could make 1 long gram and dupe it, adding only brief personal messages and endearments, before shooting the almost identical copies off to Mars and to Earth. Of course, it was highly unlikely that his wives ever would do such a thing, even at the concessionary rates allowed to spacemen's families. It would be expensive, and there would be no point in it. His families were on excellent terms with each other and exchanged the usual greetings on birthdays and anniversaries. Yet, on the whole, Perhaps it was just as well that the girls had never met, and probably never would. Myrna had been born on Mars, and so could not tolerate the high gravity of Earth. And Caroline hated even the 25 minutes of the longest possible terrestrial journey.
"Sorry I'm a day late with this transmission," said Norton, after he had finished the general purpose preliminaries. "But I've been away from the ship for the last 30 hours, believe it or not."
"Don't be alarmed. Everything is under control, going perfectly. It's taken us 2 days, but we're almost through the airlock complex. We could have done it in a couple of hours if we'd known what we do now. But we took no chances, sent remote cameras ahead, and cycled all the locks a dozen times to make sure they wouldn't seize up behind us, after we'd gone through. Each lock is a simple revolving cylinder with a slot on one side. You go in through this opening, crank the cylinder around 180 degrees, and the slot then matches up with another door so you can step out of it. Or float, in this case. The Ramans really made sure of things. There are 3 of these cylinder locks, one after the other, just inside the outer hull and below the entry pillbox. I can't imagine how even one would fail unless someone blew it up with explosives, but if it did, there would be a second backup and then a third. And that's only the beginning. The final lock opens into a straight corridor, almost 0.5 kilometer long. It looks clean and tidy, like everything else we've seen. Every few meters there are small ports that probably held lights, but now everything is completely black, and I don't mind telling you, scary. There are also 2 parallel slots, about 1 centimeter wide, cut in the walls and running the whole length of the tunnel. We suspect that some kind of shuttle runs inside these to tow equipment or people back and forth. It would save us a lot of trouble if we could get it working. I mentioned that the tunnel was 0.5 kilometer long. Well, from our seismic soundings, we knew that that's about the thickness of the shell, so obviously we were almost through it. And at the end of the tunnel, we weren't surprised to find another of those cylindrical airlocks. Yes, and another, and another. These people seem to have done everything in threes. We're in the final lock chamber now, waiting for the okay from Earth before we go through. The interior of Rama is only a few meters away. I'll be a lot happier when the suspense is over. You know Jerry Kirchhoff, my exec, who's got such a library of real books that he can't afford to emigrate from Earth? Well, Jerry told me about a situation just like this, back at the beginning of the 20th century. An archaeologist found the tomb of an Egyptian king, the first one that hadn't been looted by robbers. His workmen took months to dig their way in, chamber by chamber, until they came to the final wall. Then they broke through the masonry, and he held out a lantern and pushed his head inside. He found himself looking into a whole roomful of treasure. Incredible stuff, gold and jewels. Perhaps this place is also a tomb. It seems more and more likely. Even now, there's still not the slightest sound or hint of any activity. Well, tomorrow we should know. Norton switched the recorder to hold. What else, he wondered, should he say about the work before he began the separate personal messages to his families? Normally, he never went into so much detail, but these circumstances were scarcely normal. This might be the last gram he would ever send to those he loved. He owed it to them to explain what he was doing. By the time they saw these images and heard these words, he would be inside Rama, for better or for worse. 8. Through the Hub. Never before had Norton felt so strongly his kinship
with that long-dead Egyptologist. Not since Howard Carter had first peered into the tomb of Tutankhamen could any man have known a moment such as this. Yet the comparison was almost ridiculously ludicrous. Tutankhamen had been buried only yesterday, not even 4,000 years ago. Rama might be older than mankind. That little tomb in the Valley of the Kings could have been lost in the corridors through which they had already passed, but the space that lay beyond this final seal was at least a million times greater. And as for the treasure it might hold, that was beyond imagination. No one had spoken over the radio circuits for at least 5 minutes. The well-trained team had not even reported verbally when all the checks were complete. Mercer had simply given him the OK sign and waved him toward the open tunnel. It was as if everyone realized that this was a moment for history, not to be spoiled by unnecessary small talk. That suited Norton, for at the moment he, too, had nothing to say. He flicked on the beam of his flashlight, triggered his jets, and drifted slowly down the short corridor, trailing his safety line behind him. Only seconds later, he was inside. Inside what? All before him was total darkness. Not a glimmer of light was reflected back from the beam. He had expected this, but he had not really believed it. All the calculations had shown that the far wall was tens of kilometers away. Now his eyes told him that this was indeed the truth. As he drifted slowly into that darkness, he felt a sudden need for the reassurance of his safety line, stronger than any he had ever experienced before, even on his first EVA. And that was ridiculous. He had looked out across the light years and the megaparsecs without vertigo. Why should he be disturbed by a few cubic kilometers of emptiness? He was queasily brooding over this problem when the momentum damper at the end of the line braked him gently to a halt, with a barely perceptible rebound. He swept the vainly probing beam of the flashlight down from the nothingness ahead to examine the surface from which he had emerged. He might have been hovering over the center of a small crater, which was itself a dimple in the base of a much larger one. On either side rose a complex of terraces and ramps, all geometrically precise and obviously artificial, which extended for as far as the beam could reach. About 100 meters away, he could see the exits of the other two airlock systems, identical with this one. And that was all. There was nothing particularly exotic or alien about the scene. In fact, it bore a considerable resemblance to an abandoned mine. He felt a vague sense of disappointment. After all this effort, there should have been some dramatic, even transcendental, revelation. Then he reminded himself that he could see only a couple of 100 meters. The darkness beyond his field of view might yet contain more wonders than he cared to face. He reported briefly to his anxiously waiting companions, then added, "I'm sending out the flare. 2-minute delay. Here goes." With all his strength, he threw the little cylinder straight upward, or outward, and started to count seconds as it dwindled along the beam. Before he had reached the quarter minute, it was out of sight. When he had got to 100, he shielded his eyes and aimed the camera. He had always been good at estimating time. He was only 2 seconds off when the world exploded with light, and this time there was no cause for disappointment. Even the millions of candle power of the flare could not light up the whole of this enormous cavity, but he could see enough to grasp its plan and appreciate its titanic scale. He was at one end of a hollow cylinder at least 10 kilometers wide and of indefinite length. From his viewpoint at the central axis, he could see such a mass of detail on the curving walls surrounding him that his mind could not absorb more than a minute fraction of it. He was looking at the landscape of an entire world by a single flash of lightning, and he tried, by a deliberate effort of will, to freeze the image in his mind. All around him, the terraced slopes of crater rose up until they merged into the solid wall that rimmed the sky. No, that impression was false. He must discard the instincts both of Earth and of space and reorientate himself to a new system of coordinates. He was not at the lowest point of this strange inside-out world, but the highest. From here, all directions were down, not up. If he moved away from this central axis toward the curving wall, which he must no longer think of as a wall, gravity would steadily increase. When he reached the inside surface of the cylinder, he could stand upright on it at any point, feet toward the stars and head toward the center of the spinning drum. The concept was familiar enough. Since the earliest dawn of spaceflight, centrifugal force had been used to simulate gravity. It was only the scale of this application that was so overwhelming, so shocking. The largest of all space stations, SyncSat-5, was less than 200 meters in diameter. It would take some little while to grow accustomed to 100 times that size. The tube of landscape that enclosed him was mottled with areas of light and shade that could have been forests, fields, frozen lakes, or towns. The distance and the fading illumination of the flare made identification impossible. Narrow lines that could be highways, canals, or well-trained rivers formed a faintly visible geometrical network, and far along the cylinder, at the very limit of vision, was a band of deeper darkness. It formed a complete circle, ringing the interior of this world, and Norton suddenly recalled the myth of Oceanus, the sea that, the ancients believed, surrounded the earth. Here, perhaps, was an even stranger sea, not circular, but cylindrical. Before it became frozen in the interstellar night, did it have waves and tides and currents and fish? The flare guttered and died. The moment of revelation was over. But Norton knew that as long as he lived, these images would be burned in his mind. Whatever discoveries the future might bring, they could never erase this first impression. And history could never take from him the privilege of being the first of all mankind to gaze upon the works of an alien civilization.